The silence stretched between them, and to Cinta it felt like a cocoon or a web they were snared in. Struggling just made it worse. In the hills high above the savannah of her homeland, there were ancient tombs carved into cliff faces. Barely past her first blooding, she journeyed with her sister and two others to explore those mysterious caves. Nothing but dust. The stone sarcophagi were stacked a dozen to each chamber, and Cinta remembered standing in the relative chill, one hand holding a makeshift torch, and in the flickering, wavering orange light staring at the lowest coffin in a stack rising before her. Other peoples buried their dead instead of gifting the corpse to the vulture goddess and her get, or sealed them beneath heavy lids of stone, and she remembered thinking, with a chill rippling through her, "But what if they got it wrong? What if you weren't dead?" In the years since, she'd heard horrifying tales of hapless people buried alive, trapped within coffins of stone or wood. Life in the barracks was rife with stories intended to make one shiver, worse than the haranguing threats from priests behind a pulpit, and everyone knew those ones were doing it for the coin, and all that delicious sharing out of fear. "And now I feel as if I'm about to wake up from a long sleep. From my mouth, a sighing breath. But all I see is darkness. All I hear is a strange, dull echo all around me. And I reach up and find cold, damp stone. It was the drops that awakened me, a condensation of my own breathing. I'm about to wake up to find that I've been buried alive." The terror would not let her go. This desert belongs to the dead. Its song is the song of dying. In the wagon, lumbering a few strides ahead, sat her sister, head lolling as if asleep. Was it that easy for her? That leg was slow in mending, and now that they were in this lifeless place, no healer could help her. She must be in pain. Yet she slept. "While we march." The deserter never deserted after all. Who could have guessed she'd find something inside, something that reached out beyond, outside her damned self? "We can never know, can we? Can never know someone else, even one of our own blood. Kiss where? You should have run, limped, done whatever you needed to do. I could manage all of this, I could, if I knew you were safe, far away." She thought back to when her sister had appeared in the company of the Kundril, that ragged, wretched huddle of survivors. Young mothers, old mothers, crippled warriors, unblooded children. Elders tottering like the harbingers of shattered faith. And there she was, struggling with a makeshift crutch, the kind one saw among broken veterans on foreign streets as they begged for alms. Gods below, at least the Malazan Empire knew how to honour their veterans. You don't just up and forget them, ignore them, step over them in the gutters. You honour them. Even the kin of the lost get coin and a holy day in their honour. There were, she knew, all kinds of coffins, all kinds of ways of finding out you've been buried alive. How many people dreaded opening their eyes, opening them for real? How many were terrified of what they would find? That stone box, that solid darkness, the immovable walls and lid and the impossible weight. Her sister would not meet her eye, would not even speak to her, not since Kiswear's return to the ranks. But return she did, and soldiers saw that, saw and realized that she'd gone to get the Kundril to find help for that awful day. They understood, too, how Kiswear must feel, there in that ruined haggle of survivors. Aye, she'd sent the rest of them to their deaths, enough to destroy the strongest among them, aye. But look at her. Seems able to bear it. The broken leg? She was riding hood bent for leather, friends. Would have been in that fatal charge, too, if not for her horse going down. No, they now looked on Kiswear with a seriousness to their regard that spoke tomes about finally belonging, that spoke of seeing on her the fresh scars from the only rite of passage worth respecting, surviving with the coin paid in full for the privilege. Well, that is my sister, isn't it? No matter what, she will shine. She will shine. Kissware could feel her teeth grinding, on the edge of cracking, as the wagon clunked over yet another rock, and with breath held she waited for the rush of stunning pain. Up from the bones of her leg, spreading like bright flowers through her hips, rising through her torso like a tree with 1,000 stabbing branches and 10,000 needled twigs. Higher still, the mad serrated leaves unfurling in her skull, lacerating her brain. She rode the manic surge, the insane growth of agony, and then, as it pulsed back down, as it ebbed, she slowly released her sour breath. She stank of suffering. She could taste it on her swollen tongue. She leaked it out on the grimy boards beneath her. They should have left her behind, a lone tent in the rubbish of the abandoned camp. That would have been an act of mercy. But since when did armies think about that? Their whole business was the denial of mercy, and like a watermill, the huge stone wheel of destruction rolled on and on. No one allowed to get off. On what? She found herself grinning. On pain of death, that's what. Staring at her own knees, at the thick bundling of myriad skins surrounding her splintered leg, hair hanging down, hiding from her eyes Badan Gruk, Cinta, and all the rest, so useless in their clumping along, so bitter in all the ghosts they now carried, the weight bowing them down. Was it pores or kindly? Yes, pores. Grow that hair, woman! Or was it cut it? I can't remember. How can I not remember? Was it that long ago? Pores, pretending to be kindly. Where does that kind of courage come from? That audacity? That knowing look will be in his eye right up until he's shoved through Hood's gate. It will, won't it? How I admire people like that. How I wanted to be like them. Badan Gruk, take a lesson from pores, I beg you. No more of the sad eyes, the hurt look. I see it, and I want to stab deeper, lash out. I want to make true all your miserable worries, all those wounds upon your heart. Let's see them bleed. The wagon jarred beneath her. She gasped. Flowers and trees, leaves of fire igniting behind her eyes. No time to think. Every thought tried running, only to explode in the forest. Bursting awake all the leaves, high in the canopy, and every thought wings away, like birds into the sky. The leg was infected. There was fever, and nothing anyone could do about it. Herbs fought the good war, or they would if there were any. If she asked for them, if she told someone. Pastes and poultices, elixirs and unguents. All the ranks of grim-faced soldiers, banners waving, marching into disease's grinning face. No one's allowed to get off, on pain of death, aye. Stay right here, this rocking wagon, the rank sweat of the oxen so sweet in our nostrils. We got us a war, comrades. Can't stop and chat. We got us a war, and no one's allowed to get off. No one's allowed to get off. No one's allowed to... Badan grunted and looked up. Shit, said Cinta, starting forward. Kissware had been leaning forward over her thighs, one leg dangling off the wooden tail, the other splinted straight, thrust out at an angle. She'd just fallen back, head cracking as it bounced on the slats. Cinta clambered onto the wagon.
Gods below, she's on fire! Badan, get us a cutter, fast!
Straightening, she faced forward and leaned over the bundles of gear.
Ruffle, pull this thing over to one side! Hurry! Out of the line!
Aye, Sergeant.
They're pulling out a line, Sergeant. Should we go back and see what's up?
Pelion scowled.
Just march, Corporal.
It was dark, but not so dark as it maybe should be. People glowed green, but then could be that was how it always was when she didn't drink.
No wonder I'd drink. Listen, all of you, she said. Keep an eye out.
For what?
Breathy asked.
For a tavern, of course, idiot.
They'd gotten two transfers. From the 7th Squad, a pair of swords, one of them with a bad knee and the other one with the face of a gutsick horse. Limp's the name of one of them, but which one? That other one. Crump. A sapper? Is Crump the sapper? But sappers ain't worth much now, are they? Big enough to be a sword, though, unless Crump is the one with the bad knee. Imagine a sapper with a bad knee. Set the charge and run! Well, hobble, fast as you can. Guess you looking like a horse was some kind of joke, huh? Sappers, nothing but a bad idea that stayed bad. Bust up one leg on all of them. That'd make the breed extinct quick enough. Aye, Limp's the sapper, Crump's the other one. Crump goes the knee, Limp goes the sapper. But wait, which one's got the bad knee again? I could turn round, I suppose. Turn round and say, take a look. Which one's limping? Get the limper sorted and I got Crump, meaning the sapper's the other one, with the bad knee. Limp, then. He's named Limp on account of the bad knee of his buddies, since he has to help the fool along all the time. But then, if he got that name at the start, why, he'd not make it as a soldier at all. He'd have been drummed out or planted behind a desk. So the sapper didn't run fast enough from some fuse. That's how he earned his name. Got the name Crump on account of a crumpling knee. Now I get it. Phew! But what's the point of a horse with a bad knee? It's getting cold, Sergeant. Pellion's scowl deepened. What do you want me to do about it, fart in your face? No, was just saying. Oh, and Limp's lagging. We should have stuck him on the wagon. Who are you again? I may be, Sergeant. Been with you since the beginning. Which door? What? The street we lived on in Kartul City. Which door was you in? I ain't from Kartul, Sergeant. I meant the beginning of the squad. That's what I meant. Aran, Seven Cities. The first time we marched across a hood-rotting desert. Back to Yucatan? No wonder I'm so thirsty. Got water in that jug there, soldier? Just my piss, Sergeant. Lucky you ain't a woman. Try pissing into a bottle when you're a woman. Yucatan, gods below, how many times do we got to take that place? We ain't marching to Yucatan, Sergeant. We're... Oh, never mind. It's a desert for sure, though. Cold.
Corporal Touchless?
Sergeant?
What you got in that jug there?
Piss.
Who's selling that stuff anyway? Bloody genius.
Maybe, said. Heard the quartermaster was tying bladders on the Kundril stallions. Pellion frowned.
They'd explode. Why would he do that? And more to the point, how? Stick your hand up, it's...
Not the horse's bladder, Sergeant. Water skins, right? Cow bladders, tied to the stallion's cock.
Duck, you mean?
What?
Horses hate cocks, but they don't mind ducks. But that bladder would slow 'em down something awful. Quite the farm where you grew up, maybe.
I ain't fooled, you know, said Maybe, leaning close. But I see the point, right? You're keeping us entertained. It's like a game, pieces jumping every which way. She eyed him.
Oh, I'm just fooling with you, am I?
He met her gaze, and then his eyes shied away. Sorry, Sergeant. Feeling it, huh? Pellion said nothing.
Glowing green, aye. And all those rocks and shards out there where the spiders are. Tiny eyes all heaped up, all watching me pass. I'm sober, can't pretend they're not there, not any more. And not a tavern in sight. This is going to be bad, very bad. Hear that? She asked. That was a damned hyena.
That was Throat Slitter, Sergeant.
He killed a hyena? Good for him. Where's Balgrid anyway?
Dead.
Damned slacker. I'm going to sleep. Corporal, you're in charge.
Can't sleep now, Breathless objected. We're walking, Sergeant.
Best time for it, then. Wake me when the sun comes up.
Now that ain't fair how she does that. Breathless grunted.
You hear about them all the time, though. Those veterans who can sleep on the march.
He mused and then grunted a second time.
Didn't know she was one of them.
Sober now, maybe muttered. That's what's new with her.
Did you see her and Herb and Tar heading back into the trench? I just about given up, and then I saw her, and she pulled me along as if I was wearing chains round my neck. I had nothing left, me and Touchy. Remember Touchy? Aye, what of it? We were finished. When I saw Quick Ben go down, it was like someone carved out my gut. I went all hollow inside. Suddenly, I knew it was time to die.
You were wrong, said Maybe in a growl.
We got us a good sergeant, is what I'm saying.
Maybe nodded and glanced back at Crump. You listening, soldier? Don't mess it up. The tall, long-faced man with the strangely wide-spaced eyes blinked confusedly.
They stepped on my cusses, he said. Now I ain't got any more.
Can you use that sword on your belt, sapper?
What, this? No, why would I want to do that? We're just marching.
Lagging behind, breath coming in harsh gasps, Limp said,
Crump had a bag of munitions. Stuck his brain in there, too, for a safekeeping. It all went up, throwing Naruk everywhere. He's just an empty skull now, maybe.
So, he can't fight? What about using a crossbow?
Never seen him try one of those. But fight? Crump fights. Don't worry about that.
Well, with what, then? That stupid bush knife?
He uses his hands, maybe.
Well, that's just great, then.
We're just marching, said Crump again, and then he laughed.
Herb glanced back at the squad, trudging 5 paces behind his own. She had nothing to drink now. She was waking up to who she really was. And maybe she didn't like what she saw. Wasn't that what drinking was all about to begin with? He rubbed the back of his neck, faced forward again. Sober now. Eyes clear. Clear enough to see... Well, it wasn't like she'd really shown any interest. And besides, did he really want to get tangled with someone like that? Standing up only to probably fall down again? It was a narrow path for people like her, and they needed to want to walk it. If they didn't, off they went again, sooner or later, every time. Of course, if what Fid had said was true, what did any of it even matter? They were the walking dead, looking for a place to finish up with all the walking. So in the meantime, if there was a chance at anything, why not take it? She'd not be serious about it, though, would she? She'd just mock the whole idea of love, of what he would end up cutting out and slapping down wet and red on the table between them. She'd just laugh. He wasn't brave enough for that. In fact, he wasn't brave at all about anything. Not fighting Naruk or Lethary or Whirlwind fanatics. Every time he had to draw his sword, he went cold as ice inside. Loose, quaking, dread shivering out from his stomach to steal the heat from his limbs. He drew his sword expecting to die, and die poorly. But he'd do what he could to keep her alive. Always had. Always would. Usually she was too drunk to even see it, or maybe she was so used to him being there when it counted that he was no different from a stone wall for her to throw her back against. But wasn't even that enough for him? It would have to be, because he didn't have the courage for anything more. Being the walking dead didn't have a thing to do with bravery. It was just a way of looking at the time left, of ducking down and pushing on and not complaining. He could do that. He'd been doing that all his life, in fact. I've been the walking dead all along, and I didn't even know it. The thought left him weakened, as if some hidden knife had just pushed deep inside, piercing his soul. I've been telling myself this was being alive. This here, this hiding, wishing, dreaming, wanting. And all the while, what does anyone else see when they look at me? Quiet Herb. Not much going on in there, is there? But a fair soldier. Adequate. Made sergeant, sure,
but don't ever think he'll go higher. Hasn't got it inside, you see. It's quiet as a cave in there. But you got to, well, admire him. He's a man without troubles. He's a man who lives it easy, if you know what I mean. That's Sergeant Herb. He'll do until a better sergeant comes along. Hiding ain't living. Hiding's just walking dead.
He looked up into the jade-lit night sky, studied those grim slashes cleaving the darkness. Huge now, seeming ready to slice into the face of this very world. Herb shivered.
But if I'm the walking dead, why am I still so afraid?
Corporal Clasp dropped back from her position alongside Herb until Saltlick, who'd been taking up the rear, reached her and she fell in beside him.
"Can I have a quiet word with you?"
she asked. He glanced over, blinked.
"I could be quiet."
"I'd noticed, Saltlick. Is that how it is in this squad?"
"What do you mean?"
She nodded ahead.
"Sergeant Herb, you and him are the same. You don't say anything. Don't give yourselves away. You know, we all knew there was a kind of elite group, squads and a few heavies. Somehow all closer to Fiddler back when he was a sergeant, closer than the rest of us. We knew it. We could see it. Fiddler and round him, Gessler and Stormy, Balm and Hellion, Cord and Shard, and Herb. With Quick Ben dropping in and then Hedge. And finally, some of you heavies, Shortnose, Mayfly, Flashwit, you. I know it was all about Fiddler, and the ones he drew in around him, the ones he picked."
Saltlick was staring at her now. Clasp grimaced.
"Look at my soldiers," she said under her breath. "Look at Sad. You know what she is? A damned Semk witch. Semk. You know what she does when she gets ready for a fight? Never mind. You'll see for yourself, assuming we survive this desert. Then there's Burnt Rope. Sapper. But he surprised me at the trench. So did our cutter. You know, he once went and sought out Gessler and Stormy. Fellow Falaris, right? We sent him. We sent Laptwirl to Gess and Stormy to test them out. To see if we could get in."
"Get in?"
"To those elites. To the insiders, right? Well, he didn't get anywhere. They were friendly enough, and the three of them got drunk. It was in Letharas. Got beastly drunk and hired up a whole whorehouse of women. But Lap kept a bit of himself cold sober, and when he judged it right, he just went and asked. Asked in. You know what Gessler said?"
Saltlick shook his head.
"The bastard denied it to Lap's face. Said it didn't exist. Lied to Lap's face. That's how we know there's no getting in."
Saltlick continued studying her.
"So," he said after a few strides, "why are you telling me?"
"Herb's one of the finest sergeants we Marines got left to us. We know that. In fact, it's got us pissing in our boots. The pressure's getting unbearable, Saltlick. We can't get a word out of him. And you can see in his eyes, he's damned disappointed to be settled with us."
"All right," said Saltlick.
She frowned up at him.
"All right, what?"
"You're in, Corporal. You and your soldiers. You're all in."
"Really? Are you sure?"
"You're in."
Smiling, she moved ahead again, paused to glance back and nod. He nodded back, saw the lightness in her step, watched as she leaned in close to Laptwirl, and the two soldiers spoke in whispers and gestures, and a moment later Sad and Burnt Rope closed up to listen in. Faces turned, looked back at him. He waved.
"I can't wait till Flashwit hears this one."
Saltlick shifted uncomfortably. He'd sweated a lot in his tent, and now his sack was chafing. He could almost feel the skin peeling off.
"Fuck, that stings. Better air out my balls tomorrow."
The sergeant was glaring at her, gesturing. Flashwit frowned. Mayfly nudged her.
"Wants to talk to you."
"Why?"
"He has 7 questions. How would I know? Go on, Princess. The idiot lost his whole squad. He probably wants to try and explain, so he doesn't get a knife in his back."
"I wouldn't stick a knife in his back," Flashwit said, shaking her head, "no matter what he did."
"Really?"
If he killed them all and told me about it, I'd just break his neck. A knife in the back, that's cowardly.
No, it ain't, Mayfly objected. It's making a point. Victim's not worth a look in the eye when you kill him. Victim's not supposed to know what ended it, just that it ended. And there's Hood's gate calling him.
But sometimes you miss.
Better go, he's getting cross.
Grunting, Flashwit made her way up to Sergeant Gaunt-Eye. Wasn't a friendly face, that one, but a face a person would remember, anyway, for all the wrong things in it.
Sergeant?
You don't know the hand talk, soldier.
What talk? Oh, that. Yeah, I know it. Mostly. Advance, stop, hit the ground, fight, go fuck yourself. Like that.
A Marine should know how to put together whole sentences, Flashwit.
Yeah? I'm a heavy sergeant.
Tell me about the girly one.
Using my hands? Can't, Sergeant. I mean, I'd have to try and ask, what girly one? And I don't know how to do that.
Skull death. Talk to me, soldier, with words, but keep your voice down.
I ain't never raised my voice, not once, Sergeant, in my whole life.
Skull death.
What about him?
Why is he so girly, for one?
He's a prince, Sergeant, from some tribe in Seven Cities. He's the heir, in fact.
Then what in Hood's name is he doing here?
She shrugged.
They sent him to grow up somewhere else, with us, to see the world and all that.
Gaunt-Eye bared crooked teeth.
Bet he's regretting that.
No reason why, Flashwit said. Not yet, anyway.
So he grew up all pampered and perfumed, then?
I suppose.
So how did he get that stupid name?
Flashwit squinted at the sergeant.
Begging your pardon, Sergeant, but where was you and your squad? Back at the trench, I mean.
He shot her a vicious look.
What difference does that make?
Well, you couldn't have not seen him then. Skull death. He jumps high, you see. He was the only one of us cutting Naruk throats, right? Jumps high, like I said. See those 8 notches on his left wrist?
Those burns?
Aye, one for each Naruk he personally throat cut.
Gaunt-Eye snorted.
A liar, too, then. About what I figured.
But he never counted, Sergeant. Never does. 8 is what we saw him do. Those who saw him at all, I mean. We talked about it, comparing and all that. 8. So we told him, and he burned those marks on his wrist. When we asked him how many he gutted, he said he didn't know. When we asked him how many he hamstrung, he didn't know that either. The rest of us couldn't come up with numbers on those. Lot more than 8, though. But since we seen him burn himself, we decided not to tell him how many. He'd be one big burn now, right? And since he's so pretty, well, that'd be a shame.
She fell silent then, to catch her breath. She'd broken 3 or so ribs in the fight, so talking hurt. More than breathing, which hurt bad enough, talking was worse. That had been the most words she'd used all at once since the battle.
Draw first and may fly, said Gaunt-Eye. And you, all heavies.
Hey, Sergeant?
Get back in line, Flashwit.
She gave him a bright smile that seemed to startle him, and then fell back, past one-armed Corporal Rib, who eyed her with something like suspicion, and then Draw First and Skull Death, before positioning herself beside Mayfly.
Well?
Mayfly asked.
You was wrong,
Flashwit said with deep satisfaction.
About what?
Ha! He only asked 6 questions.
Gaunt-Eye was throwing more looks back at his squad.
Who's he want now?
Mayfly wondered. And then the sergeant pointed at Skull Death.
You blow me one more kiss, soldier, and I'll wrap your guts round your hood-damned neck.
Well, no,
Flashwit muttered. Mayfly nodded.
The prince ain't missed yet, has he?
Hedge could hear howling laughter behind him, and the breath gusted from him.
Listen to that, Bevedict. Fid slapped him up and down all right. I knew it.
The leathery alchemist tugged again on the ox lead.
Alas, Commander, I don't know what you mean by that.
Bet he gave him the old Walking Dead speech. It's like cutting shackles, that one. There was a night, you see, when Dujek One Arm himself came into the Bridgeburners' camp. We was working pale then, the tunnels. I never shifted so many boulders in my life. He came in, right, and told us what we already knew.
Hedge drew off his scorched leather cap and scratched at his fresh-shaven scalp.
We was the Walking Dead. Then he left. Left us to figure out what we were going to do about it.
What did you do?
Hedge tugged on the cap again.
Well, most of us, died. Before we even had a chance. But Whiskey Jack, he wasn't going to turn his back on any of it. And Quick Ben and Callum, gods, they just wanted to start the killing. You ain't got nothing to lose once you're the Walking Dead.
I do admit, Commander, that I don't much like being described in that manner.
Got cold feet now?
I always appreciate your wit, sir, said Bavedict. But cold feet are precisely what I don't want, if you understand me.
So buck up, then. Besides, what Fid had to say to his bone hunters, well, that's up to him. Got nothing to do with us Bridgeburners.
Presumably because the Bridgeburners have been walking dead since, Pale.
Hedge slapped him on the back.
Exactly. It's not like it's an exclusive club, right?
Sir, ventured Bavedict, was it just this afternoon that you were complaining how your old friend had turned his back on you? That you were feeling like a leper?
Things are easier when you're dead. I mean, for him. He could put me away on some shelf in his skull and leave me there.
Hedge gestured carelessly with one hand.
I get it. I always did. I just don't like it. I feel insulted. I mean, I'm back. Anyone can see that. Fidge should be happy. And Quick Ben, well, you saw what he did at the battle before he skipped out. Went and did a taste run on us. Next time we meet, him and me are going to have some words, we are.
My point, sir, was that Fiddler has actually drawn himself closer to you, if indeed he spoke of his soldiers being among the walking dead.
You might think that, Hedge said, nodding, but you'd be wrong. When you're dead, Bavedict, you ain't got no brothers. Nothing holds you together, at least not that I ever seen. Aye, the dead Bridgeburners are all together, but that's just old memories, chaining them all to each other. It's just ghostly echoes from back when they were alive. I'm telling you, Alchemist, keep doing all you can to stay alive for as long as you can, because the dead got no friends.
Bavedict sighed.
I do hope you're wrong, Commander. Did you not say the realm of the dead has changed? That the Reaper himself surrendered the unliving throne? And that this Whiskey Jack...
You never knew him. Whiskey Jack, I mean. So you'll just have to take me at my word. He's a stubborn bastard. Probably the stubbornest bastard ever to walk this world. So maybe you got a point. Maybe you can make it all different. If anyone can, it's him.
Another slap on Bavedict's shoulder.
You gave me something to think about there. Fid never did that, you know. In fact, I can't remember what he ever did for me. I'm thinking now I never really liked him at all.
How unfortunate. Did you like Whiskey Jack?
Aye, we was the best of friends. Plenty there to like, basically, in both of us. Fid was the odd one out, come to think on it.
And now Whiskey Jack rides among the dead.
Tragic, Bavedict. A damned shame.
And you loved him deeply.
So I did. So I did.
But Fiddler is still alive.
Aye.
And you never really liked him.
Just so.
In fact, you love all the dead Bridgeburners.
Of course I do.
Just not the last one left alive.
Hedge glared, and then slapped the man on the side of the head.
Why am I talking to you? You don't understand nothing.
Off he marched, up to where his company trudged. Bavedict drew out a small jar, porcelain and studded jewels. He unscrewed the top, dipped one fingertip in, drew it back and examined it, and then rubbed it across his gums.
"Die," he whispered. "But I have no intention of dying. Not ever."
Jastara finally found them, up near the head of the Kundril column. It was impressive how Hanavat managed to keep up this pace, the way she waddled with all that extra weight. It was never easy being pregnant. Sick to start, and then hungry all the time, and finally big as a bloated Bedouin, until it all ends in excruciating pain. She recalled her first time, going through all that so bright-eyed and flushed, only to lose the damned thing as soon as it came out.
"The child did what she had to do, Jastara. Showed you the journey you will know again and again. She did what she had to do, and is now returned to the Black Waters."
But other mothers didn't have to go through that, did they? It was hardly as if Jastara was blessed with a life of greatness, was it?
"Married Gaul's favorite son, though, didn't she? That woman has ambitions, if not for herself, then for her get."
Ambitions, that word now dangled like a bedraggled crow from a spear point, a rotted, withered clutch of shredded feathers and old blood.
"Watch out for widows. See how she took Gaul in? What are they doing at night when the children are asleep? Hanavat had better beware, especially as vulnerable as she is now, with a child about to drop and her husband fled from her side. No, look hard at that gilk, Widow Jastara."
There were measures of disgust, and they came close and one recoiled, and then they came back a second time and one didn't recoil quite so far. And when they crept back a third time and a fourth, when the hand reached out from the darkness to caress her bared thigh, to probe under the furs, well, sometimes disgust was like a mourner's shroud, suddenly too heavy to wear anymore.
"Look hard at her now. You can see it in her eyes."
Comfort a broken man and you take the breaking inside. What woman didn't know that? The cracks spread outward, whispering into everything within reach. It was the curse of drunks and debayang addicts and womanizers and sluts. The curse of men who spoiled young boys and girls, their own get sometimes, spoiled them forever. Accusations and proof and then all that shame, kneeling in the dirt with hands over his eyes, or her eyes, and suddenly all the disgust comes back, only now it tastes familiar. No, more than familiar, it tastes intimate.
"Do I feel soiled? Do I dare look into Hanavat's eyes?"
The question held her back, not 10 paces behind Gaul's wife.
"My mother-in-law. Oh, yes. Look at Jastara now. But you forget, she lost the man she loved. She too was wounded, maybe even broken. Of course, she couldn't show it, couldn't indulge in it, because while wife she may no longer be, mother she remains. What of me? My pain. His arms are the wrong arms, but the embrace is still warm and strong. His shoulder has taken my tears. What am I to do?"
So she held back, and the others looked at her and whispered things to each other.
"Her courage has failed her," murmured Shelamassa.
Hanavat sighed.
"Perhaps tomorrow, then. I don't know what she thinks she can say," the younger woman said, "to make this right. Cast him out is what she should do."
Hanavat glanced across at Shelamassa.
"So that is what everyone is saying, is it? That hard tone, those hard words. The most plentiful coin, spent so freely, is also the most worthless one."
Shelamassa frowned.
"What do you mean? When you are judgmental, all the paint in the world cannot hide the ugliness of your face. The viciousness inside pushes through and twists every feature. I am sorry, Hanavat. I was thinking of you. And you would take what you imagine to be my feelings and speak them back to me. You proclaim yourself the warrior at my side, the lion standing firm, to give comfort to me. I understand all that, Shelamassa. Yet what I hear from you, what I see in the eyes of the others, has nothing to do with me.
Have I asked for pity? Have I asked for allies in this hidden war? Is there even any war at all? You presume much. She will not speak to you. And how brave would you be in her stead? Her father-in-law has seduced her, taken her to his bed, or she him. Either way makes no difference. Do you think I do not know my own husband? He is difficult to resist in the best of times. And now, in his pain and his need, well, not a woman or man here could defeat his will. But you see, you are all safe from him, freeing you to cast judgment upon the one woman now in his snare. Not upon my husband, however, for what might that say about me? Do not speak to me of sides in this. There are none. There are but people, people of all sorts, each doing what they can to get by. And if what they do hurts others, Hanavat, will you martyr yourself? Will you weep for Jastara, too, who hides every day in his arms? Ah, see how I have stung you, you and your cruel judgment. My husband in his need, Jastara in her weakness. They are one and all acts of selfishness, acts of pushing away. How can you say that? I despise what they've done to you. And it tastes sweet, yes? Listen to me. I, too, am a widow now, and a mother who has lost her children. Have I need for an embrace, a stolen moment of love? Should I feel hatred for Gaul and Jastara for finding what I cannot? Shalamas's expression was appalled. Tears streaked down through the white paint on her face. Is it not your husband you should look to for that? While he still faces away from me, I cannot. Then he's the coward. To look into my eyes, Hanavat said, is to see all that we once shared and have now lost. It is too much to bear, and not just for my husband. Yes, she added, I carry his last child, and if that child is not his, well, that is for me to know in my heart, but never to be spoken. For now, I have that much. I have what I need to hold on, Shalamasa. And now so does Gaul. The younger woman shook her head. Then you stand alone, mother. He has taken his son's widow. That is unforgivable. Better, Shalamasa, much better. You see, Jastara does not deserve your hate. Not those looks, those whispers behind her back. No. Instead, to be true sisters to her, you must go to her, comfort her. And when you have done that, when all of you have done that, then I shall go to her and take her into my arms. Henar Vigolf remembered the day he acquired his first horse. His father, whose shattered hip 5 years earlier had ended his riding days, had limped at his side, using his cane as they made their way out to the pasture. A new herd had been culled from the wild herds of the high mountain plateaus, and 23 of the magnificent beasts now moved restlessly about in the enclosure. The sun was high, shrinking shadows underfoot, and the wind swept steady down the slopes, combing the high grasses, warm and sweet with the flavors of early autumn. Henar was 9 years old.
"Will one see me?" he'd asked his father. "Will one choose me?"
The tall blue rose horse breeder looked down, dark brows rising.
It's that new maid, isn't it? The one with the watermelon tits and wide eyes. From the coast, yes? Filling your head with all sorts of rubbish.
But
there's not a horse in the wide world, Henar, happy to choose a rider. Not one beast eager to serve. Not one is delighted at being broken, its will beaten down. Are they any different from you or me?
But dogs.
By the black-winged lord, Henar, dogs are bred to be four-legged slaves. Ever seen a wolf smile? Trust me, you don't want to, ever. They smile right before they lunge for your throat. Never mind dogs.
He pointed with his cane.
Those animals are wild. They have lived in utter freedom. So, see one you like?
That piebald one, off to the left on its own.
His father grunted.
A young stallion, not yet strong enough to contest the ranks. Not bad, Hanar. But I'm, well, surprised. Even from here, one animal stands out, really stands out. You're old enough, have been around me enough too. I would have thought you'd see straight off.
I did, father.
What is it, then? Do you feel you do not deserve the best out there?
Not if it means breaking them.
His father's head had rocked back then, and he'd laughed, loud enough to startle the herd. Recalling that moment of his youth, the huge warrior smiled.
Remember that day, father? I bet you do. And if you could see me now, see the woman walking at my side, why, I can almost hear that beautiful roar of your laughter. One day, father, I will bring her to you, this wild, free woman. We'll step onto that long white road, walk between the trees. They must be big by now, and up through the estate gate. I'll see you standing by the front entrance, like a statue commanding the stone itself. New lines on your face, but that hooked grin still there, in a beard now gone grey. You're leaning on your cane, and I can smell horses, like a flower's heady scent on the air, and that scent will tell me that I've come home. I'll see you studying her, noting her height, her lithe confidence, the boldness in her eyes, and you'll wonder if she's broken me, not the other way round. You can see that, not the other way round, but then you'll look into my eyes and your smile will broaden. And you'll tilt back that majestic head and laugh to the heavens. It will be the sweetest sound in the world. It will be the voice of our triumph, all of us, you, me, her. Father, I do miss you.
Lastara's calloused hand found his own, and he took some of her weight as she leaned one shoulder against him.
Bless Bryce Bedict,
she said under her breath.
Hanar nodded. I suspect a streak of the sentimental in my commander.
Be glad of it, I am.
It was unexpected.
Why? I fought for you, Hanar, not the adjunct, you. He understood.
No, not all that, beloved. All this, where we have found ourselves, and how we have found each other, for that matter.
She looked up at the strangers in the night sky.
So he gives us what time there's left to us. Less sentimental, then, more pity.
You've a dour streak, Hanar. I think I prefer Bryce's sentimental one. Maybe I'll get rid of you and ride back to him.
You'd have to fight Aranect for him, I should think.
Oh, you're right, and I couldn't do that, wouldn't. I like her far too much. Well then, seems I'm saddled with you. He smiled.
Saddled? Ah.
Hanar?
Yes?
I fear we won't be coming back from this journey.
He nodded, not because he agreed with her, but because he knew what she feared.
We're going to die, she said. In fact, we may not even make it across this desert.
There is that risk.
It's hardly fair.
I had a maid once at the country estate. Watermelon tits and big eyes.
What?
My father is terrible with names, so he came up with, memorable descriptions. Anyway, she used to tell me stories at night, long rambling tales of heroes, loves lost, loves won. She'd make every ending sweet. To make the night's dreams the same, you see?
Just what a child needs.
I suppose. But those stories weren't for me. They were for her. She was from the coast, and she'd left behind a man she loved. This was Lether, don't forget, and her whole community was trapped in the indebted way of life. It's why she came to work for our family. As for the young man, well, he was sent to sea.
He was silent for a moment, remembering, and then he said,
Every night she told me how she wanted her life to turn out. Though, of course, I didn't realize that at the time. But the truth of it was, she wanted that happy ending. She needed to believe in it, for her and for everyone else.
Lastara sighed.
What happened to her?
As far as I know, she's still there at the country estate.
Are you trying to break my heart, Hanar?
He shook his head.
My father worked the system as best he could, and he was not unkind with his indebted. About a year before I left to train with the Lancers, Watermelon Tits with Big Eyes married the son of one of our horse trainers. My last vision of her, her belly was out to here and those tits were even bigger.
She'd given up on her man from the sea then. Well, probably wise, I suppose. Part of growing up.
Hanar eyed her and then away, out over the rocky landscape.
I think about her every now and then.
He grinned.
I even used to fantasize about her, yes, in the way young men will do.
The grin faded. But mostly I see her sitting on the edge of the bed, her hands flying and her eyes getting wider, and in that bed is her own child, a boy, who will dream sweet dreams, and when the lantern is turned down, when she's standing by the door to his room, that's when the tears will run down her cheeks, and she'll remember a young man on the edge of the sea. Lastara's breathing had changed somehow, and her face was hidden from his view.
My love?
Her reply was muffled.
It's all right. Hanar, you keep surprising me, that's all.
We'll survive this, Lastara Yil, he said, and one day I will lead you by the hand up to my father's house. And we'll see him standing there waiting for us, and he will laugh.
She looked up, wiping at her cheeks.
Laugh?
There are pleasures in the world, Lastara Yil, that go beyond words.
I heard one of those pleasures once, and I will hear it again. I will.
Before I reached the lofty position of inexhaustible masturbation that is Demidrek Septak of the Great Temple, Banaskar was saying, I had to follow the same rituals as everyone else, and one of those rituals was to counsel commoners. Who knows why they'd ever seek out a priest of the Autumn Worm, but then the truth of it is, the real and true function of priests of all colors is simply that of listening to a litany of moans, fears, and confessions, all for the betterment of someone's soul. Never could figure out whose, but no matter.
He paused.
Are you actually listening, adjunct?
It appears that I have little choice, she replied.
The glass desert stretched ahead of them. A small flanking troop, scouts, he assumed, was slightly ahead and to the left, north of the vanguard, moving on foot, as was everyone else. But directly before Banaskar and the adjunct, there stretched nothing but a broken plain studded with crystals beneath a ghoulish sky. The ex-priest shrugged.
Now isn't this an interesting turn? Blessed woman, will you hear my tales of mortal woe? Will you give counsel?
The look she cast at him was unreadable, and it occurred to him, an instant later, that it was just as well. He cleared his throat.
Occasionally, one of them would complain about me, or rather, about us sanctimonious shits in these ridiculous robes and whatnot. You know what they'd be so irritated about? I'll tell you. Love, that's what.
A second glance, even briefer than the first one. He nodded.
Precisely. They asked, you, priest, you with that hand beneath the vestments, what in Hood's name do you know about love? More to the point, what do you know about romance? You see, most people end up moaning about relationships, more than being poor or lame or sick, more than any other topic you could imagine. Lovers, husbands, wives, strangers, sisters, endless confessions and desires and betrayals and all the rest. That's why the question would eventually come round. Being priests, we'd excused ourselves from the whole mess. Hardly a strong position from which to dispense inane truisms passing as advice. Do you follow me so far, adjunct?
Have you nothing to drink, Banaskar?
He kicked at a cluster of crystals, expecting them to break. They didn't. Cursing in pain under his breath, he hobbled for a few strides.
What did I know about romance? Nothing. But after enough years of listening to every possible iteration on the subject, eventually things start getting clearer.
Do they now?
They do, adjunct. Shall I expound on love and romance?
I'd rather you...
It's actually a mathematical exercise, he said. Romance is the negotiation of possibilities towards that elusive prize called love. There, you see? I wager you expected me to go on, didn't you? But I'm done. Done discussing love and romance.
Your description lacks something, Banaskar.
It lacks everything, adjunct. All that confuses and clouds, that makes murky what is in fact both simple and stupidly elegant. Or elegantly stupid, depending on your attitude to the subject.
They continued on, neither speaking for some time. The clatter and groan of the column behind them was incessant, but apart from a lone burst of laughter a while back, there was none of the ribald songs and chants, the running jests or arguments. While it was true that the adjunct had set a stiff pace, Banaskar knew that these soldiers were hardened enough to think little of it. The quiet was unnerving.
Got a desert to cross. It's cold, and it's not nearly as dark as it should be. And that alien glow whispers down on us. If I listen carefully enough, I can hear words drifting down. In all the languages of the world, but not this world, of course. Some other one, where faces lift hopefully to the heavens. Are you there? They ask, and the sky answers not. While here I walk, here I look up, and I ask, are you there? And down come the voices. Yes, we are here. Just reach. I was a sober priest back then, he said, a serious one. I listened, I counseled.
Eventually she looked over, but said nothing. Fiddler glanced to the right, southward, 40 paces distant, the head of the column, the adjunct. Beside her, the priest. Behind the two of them, a pair of fists. 8 Kundril youths walked with Fiddler, ushered out from under their mother's skirts. They'd spotted him walking alone and had drawn closer. Curious, maybe, or wanting to be doing something that might be important. Scouting, guarding the flank. He didn't send them away. Too many had that lost, hopeful look in their eyes. Dead fathers, brothers, mothers, sisters. Massive absences through which winds howled. Now they hovered, flanking him as if he was the column itself. Fiddler was silent, and they'd taken up that silence as if it would make them older, so the only sounds were the stones shifting underfoot, the scuff of moccasins, the thump of his boots, and the grind of the column. He'd seen the map. He knew what lay ahead.
Only the impossible. Without water, we will never leave this desert. Without water, all of her plans die here, and the gods will close like jackals, and then the elder gods will show their hand, and blood will spill. The crippled god will suffer terribly. All the pain and anguish he has known up to now will be nothing but prelude. They will feed on his agony, and they will feed for a long, long time. On your agony, fallen one. You are in the deck of dragons. Your house is sanctified. If we fail, that decision will prove your gravest error. It will trap you here. It will make suffering your holy writ. Oh, many will flock to you. No one likes to suffer in isolation, and no one likes to suffer for no reason. You will answer both, and make of them an illness of body, of spirit, even as the torturing of your soul goes on and on. I never said I'd like you, fallen one, but then you never said I had to. Not me, not the adjunct, not any of us. You just asked us to do what's right. We said yes, and it's done. But bear in mind, we're mortal, and in this war to come, we're fragile. Among all the players, we're the most vulnerable. Maybe that fits. Maybe it's only right that we should be the ones to raise your standard, fallen one. And ignorant historians will write of us in the guise of knowledge. They will argue over our purpose. The things we sought to do, the
They will overturn every boulder, every barrow stone, seeking our motives, looking for hints of ambition. They will compose a book of the fallen, and then argue over its significance, in the guise of knowledge, but truly, what will they know, of each of us? From that distance, from that cold, cold distance, you'd have to squint, you'd have to look hard, because we're thin on the ground, so very thin. Children always made him feel awkward. Choices he'd put aside, futures he'd long ago surrendered, and looking at them left him feeling guilty. They were crimes of necessity. Each time I turned away, each time we all did. Whiskey Jack, remember once when we stood on the ramparts at Mock's Hold? Lassine had just stepped out from the shadows. There was a child, some son of some merchant. He was bold. You told him something, Whiskey Jack. Some advice. What was it? I can't recall. I don't even know why I'm remembering any of it. Mothers were looking on from that column. Their eyes were on their children, these young legacies, and would grip tight as talons if they could. But spaces now gape, and the children edge ever closer to them, to fill what has been lost. And the mothers tell themselves it will be enough, it must be enough. Just as I tell you now, fallen one, whatever we manage to do, it will have to be enough. We will bring this book to an end, one way or another. And one more thing. Something I only realized today when I chanced to glance across and see her standing there, moments from signaling the beginning of this march. From the very first, we have lived the tale of the adjunct. First it was Lorne, back in Darujistan, and now it is Tavare Paran. The adjunct never stands in the center. She stands to one side, always. The truth of that is right there, in her title, which she will not relinquish. So what does it mean? Ah, fallen one, it means this. She will do what she has to do, but your life is not in her hands. I see that now. Fallen one, your life is in the hands of a murderer of Malazan marines and heavies. Your life is in my hands. And soon she will send us on our way. In that Malazan book of the fallen, the historians will write of our suffering, and they will speak of it as the suffering of those who served the cripple god, as something fitting. And for our seeming fanaticism, they will dismiss all that we were and think only of what we achieved or failed to achieve. And in so doing, they will miss the whole fucking point. Fallen one, we are all your children.